Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cup. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, John? Man, don't change that down. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wiggling.
Yeah, yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cut, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the Queen of Trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey, what it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
Ah. Yeah.
Was buckle your plugs. Enough respect to Larry Hoover. Yo, it's nothing but love. Plenty sex, money, murder, and drugs. Nowadays, shit get wicked. Probably gotta check your homie for bugs. Fuck it, wet them, water saturate them. These are the terms. Zero tolerance can bury, become food for the worms. Motherfucker, yo, today I gon' learn. Meth lab gon' burn. It's all fire, Esquire the firm. Glaze terminate production, the induction we hear. Yo, we pillars out in Park Hill, destroy your career. Have a toast, double Henny's cheers. Cowards pull up a chair, meet them innovators, crack your veneers. Best of money going perish, polar bears on the prowl. We got a millionaire's morale, born and raised in the shell. You even moving with the movement or bow. We out here getting it now, it's home corporation.
Hey, don't beg for forgiveness. Seven in the cipher, eyewitness. All this ABC rap, babe, my business. Y'all start, but I finish. And now I'm throwing shade, dark tinted. If my tags say I've been it, label me as authentic. New era, cause I fit it. I might snap back and spit it. Better backslap or make your backtrack about a minute. Not a pack rat, I get them rat packed up in prison. Like I'm Fat Cat while eating Jack Mac up in Clinton. I'm a class act, get my cash app just for mentions. All this crack rap pushing like Cheryl and Sandy Denton. Get my cash back, you're flipping. My youngin' don't get a whippin', I'm with rap lack. You rappers Aflac, duckin' me different. I'm past gifted, New Year's Eve like past Christmas. I'm past lifted, like the backs on you fat trippers. It's just Mr. Meth and my missus. I'm a must see on must TV, you must have missed it.
This is hands on you, reinforcing. This is live and direct.
Yeah. We are episode 586, live and direct of Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric the Media Assassin, and this show is sponsored by Buddy Boy Entertainment, Screwball Radio, Da Vinci Clothing. I got my host, T-Max, with the facts on the line tonight.
Man, what it do, man? What it do? Another super week of Off the Cuff Radio on that fresh frequency. So nice we had to do it 2 days in a row, giving y'all that hip-hop journalistic flow. Shout out to DJ Sphere, Dirty Bass Career up in New York. Shout out to our co-hosts, Sphere, Ella the Sandman, ladies from Chilla, Salila. We are live and direct and ready to get it rocking. King, once again,
yes, sir.
Great pleasure as always, my brother. Tell everybody who we got tonight on the air.
Yeah, he's going to be on in about a couple minutes. But in the meantime,
okay,
what we're going to do is, first of all, we want to thank the people once again for making this show what it is, man. Like, we at episode 586. You know how many people literally would tap out after episode 5?
Yes. I mean, to just think about it, we are 14 episodes away from 600. Man. Yeah. The history, the legends, the good times, you know, everything that we're living a dream, King. What can we say? We're living a dream.
Yeah, we had a great bill last night, as a matter of fact. That was one of our best shows.
And shout out to Peter Spirer, author and director of the Rhyme and Reason book, and of course, director of the Rhyme and Reason documentary. Shout out to Kelly Bevan, who helped us put it together. Shout out to Rugged Entertainment, the whole staff. King, the history, the stories we got, and we definitely got to get him on for a part two, because we ain't even get a half of what we wanted to talk about in terms of everything that man has accomplished. True gem for the culture, a treasure to the human race for what he has documented from all aspects, from hip-hop to the indigenous. Peter,
yes,
we thank you so much for joining us. Oh, yeah. They got to get the link for the video. They got to get the link, too.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely going to send that to him. I'm going to send that to him after the show here. But now, we're going to talk about the star of the hour. And tonight's guest, he just dropped a fire album titled Cartridge. So here with us, not to only talk about his new project, but also to give us a story about his grind, his motivation, his music, and his story overall. Let's all welcome Hands One to Off the Cuff Radio, episode 586. What's good, brother?
Peace.
Welcome,
peace,
man. Welcome. Yeah, we hear
yes,
you.
Sir.
Welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate y'all having me on.
Yeah, man, it's great to have you on with us tonight, man. How you doing?
I'm maintaining, just in the studio, regular night.
Heard that. Look, King told me all about you and your illustrious history of being the rhyme genius in your craft, man. I mean, obviously, the opening track, you know, with Meth was something that was definitely marvelous. We're glad to have you with us. Let everybody know who you are and tell everybody a bit about yourself.
Thank you. My name is Hands On, you know, Staten Island native, New York, you know, got a project out circulating right now called Carthage, you know what I'm saying, featuring a lot of heavyweights, you know what I'm saying, just trying to reintroduce myself back to the industry.
Absolutely. Tell everybody about your journey in hip-hop. Where did it all start in terms of who influenced you? Obviously, being from Staten Island, you know, obviously the rhyme pedigree, the history is impeccable in terms of parts of the members of the Wu being from there. Tell everyone about your journey.
Well, you know, I came up in Park Hill Project, same as, you know, a lot of the Wu-Tang members. They was older. So I got to say that they influenced my music, you know what I'm saying? You know, just growing up in my hood, you know, music was a thing. I was watching the big homies do their thing, and, you know, they showed me how to, you know, turn it into a dollar and turn it into a living. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, that was one of the blessings in my life.
Absolutely. Obviously,
that's what it is.
In terms of where coming up, in terms of watching OGs do it, the Wu-Tang, obviously, the history is very, very distinguished and decorated in itself. Looking at what they did for Staten Island, how big was it for you all when they blew to know that, you know, I could do this too, and I can, you know, add my name to the pantheon of legends?
I mean, as soon as me personally, I'm going to speak for me, as soon as I've seen it. You know, because it was in front of your face, and I did a little time in jail. So in between the time where they made their transition from rhyming in the streets and doing it as a hobby to making it, you know, into, you know, making a living of it. So when I came home, it was just like night and day. It's like, you know, people don't live in the projects no more. People are making money and living, making a good living off doing what they enjoy. And, you know, it was like only thing I could do was follow.
Yeah, it's kind of like transitioning yourself into a different period, because the way hip-hop is, man, it changes fast. Like, what used to be in style 3 years ago is no longer even the trend no more.
Right. 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 So, yeah, so the night and day part in my journey was, you know, seeing dudes on one stage where, you know, it wasn't bringing in any money, and, you know, it was just a dream, you know what I'm saying, into where they were, who they was. Like, you know, I came home right around the time Cuban Link came out.
Mm-hmm.
Cuban Link 2. I'm sorry. Cuban Links 2 came out. Right before that, I came home, and, you know, things was different for Ray and for Meth, and, you know, it shit was different. So the same OGs I was, you know, looking up to in the hood, you know, they was those same OGs, but they grew to a point where, you know, now it's serious. Like, they doing what they love. They making a living off of it. You know, I felt like I had stripes against me anyway because I was incarcerated. You know, the same old story, you know, kid from the hood goes to jail, incarcerated, comes home, can't get a job, stuff like that. So fortunately, I was able to follow that and, you know, make a decent living for myself in the process.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and you were being a part of, and you being a part of the Ice Water click, and then you making that transition into, you know, establishing your own label called Hands On Music. Like, what is that day-to-day operation like, being your independent entity?
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of multitasking. It's wearing different hats. You know, it's an acquired taste. Like, a person got to get used to it, and, you know, it's just always work, you know.
When people come into the game, Hands, because obviously, you know, to see you, you're an inspiration for being incarcerated, to definitely using your intelligence and constructing some of the most invincible iron bars, you know, spitting hard, to really, really show people that there is a way out, even when some would say there is none. Looking at how the game is today, what is it do you feel about some artists coming into the game of who aspire to be MCs, and what this really means in terms of, number one, sharpening your craft to be good at it, and number two, understanding the responsibility of what it means to make this your job and staying away from being locked up?
Okay. I mean, that's kind of a hard question to answer. Why? Because for some reason, the wave of new artists nowadays think knocking at the penitentiary is the way they will get it.
Right.
And I can't even begin to explain the logic in that myself, like, because I see it, and, you know, it's, you know, the state of music not sonically, but the state of music with these young guys coming up now is kind of in shambles, because it's like, it seems like they're glorifying the wrong thing.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? And the things that's being glorified is basically going to land you back in jail. You know what I mean? At some point.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And, you know, we all come from a generation in terms of where the talent spoke for itself in terms of how you really let it stand out. You know, King and myself were in our 40s. You know, our understanding of it as the culture, as what it meant for respect in the street, how you stayed out of trouble, if you were in some trouble in terms of things you shouldn't have been doing, how you didn't let it get out there to get incarcerated. It's almost now we're seeing a totally different vibe now. It's like a lot of times we're seeing these younger artists coming into the game. Not only are they bragging about, you know, not only are they doing it, they're bragging about it. You know, and their thing is, yeah, it's like they're almost wanting to broadcast any type of nefarious, criminal, or outright crazy activities for celebrities. You know, the generation we came out of, you didn't do that. You know, you were crazy to be talking about what you were doing on the block if you were really living that life.
Right. Nobody knew how much money you had. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's like you didn't advertise
exactly
where you lived. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and one thing about it, we knew that, you know, prison was bad, you know, and that's something that I think a lot of artists don't understand today in terms of, you know, we won't obviously ask about your experiences on the inside, that says enough as is, but it's like, you know, it's like they don't really understand, like, what comes on the other side once you find yourself behind them walls, and it's like it's not a place you want to be, period.
Right. Absolutely, for a multitude of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Most important one being you don't get none of that time back.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? All of that is, every day you spend in there is a day that you'll never get back again the rest of your life.
Mm. And that's fact. When you got out, like King said, and you were getting on your grind, you know, with your label and everything, what was it like in terms of the hip-hop scene in general? You got out in 2009. That's when Cuban Links 2 was released. Obviously, a masterwork album by Raekwon. And the hip-hop scene was diametrically different from what it was before, you know, you took your, you know, your vacation. When you think about how it worked from the magazines and the mixtape being the impetus, the push, the press push for artists to get out there, and it was kind of still out there right then, but then, you know, the internet started to come up a little more, you know. Black Planet was still around, but you figure, you know, this is when MySpace and a little something called Facebook was beginning to come into the play. And Twitter, I don't think, had come in just yet. But it was still a point of where what was considered the old way of marketing music was making way for the new way of broadcasting your product. How did you see that from what it took in terms of the metrics of how it was marketed and how your talent had to stand out in a new way of exposure?
That question kind of lost me. You can say that again?
How did you navigate it in terms of finding the new ways of how music was being marketed online and how social media, although nascent, was becoming consequential in dictating somebody's ascent in the industry?
I mean, I gotta say that it was kind of a blessing. It kind of made things easier for independent artists. It created an environment where you didn't have to be signed to one of these big labels for people to get your music. You know what I'm saying? It's just utilizing it in the correct way. You know what I'm saying? Because anything you misuse is, you know what I mean, ain't going to work out for you. You know what I mean? But as long as you, you know, exercise it in the correct way, then you don't need a Sony or a Def Jam or any one of those other big giants to, you know, make a living or make something of yourself or get your music out there to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you got to let the music speak for yourself.
Right. Right. I can only speak for myself. You know what I'm saying?
Musically, how did you feel about what was out during that time? Because we're about about the mid-2000s, we see the trap rap and the snap rap really becoming a thing. Shout to Jeezy, you know, with him dropping 101 back in 2005. Of course,
right.
Jim Jones would drop POME, Probably My Environment, in 2006. That would have the hit Ballin'. You also saw artists like Soulja Boy, Shop Boys, you know, GS4, Crime Mob. So it was a very eclectic and diverse mix, where New
right.
York had always been held at a certain level of prominence and esteem. While New York was always respected, New York wasn't necessarily the focus anymore. The focus has shifted to the South.
Right.
And of course, we can't
right.
forget Game. We can't forget Game. You know, he dropped his album in January 05. So we're seeing a whole different new kind of hip-hop really coming in. And obviously, you're New York to the core and proud of it. You know, so what was that like in terms of selling, you know, your music, in terms of letting everybody know, like, New York still got this?
I mean, you know, it's always something to prove when you're MC or you consider yourself an MC. So, you know, it just made the playing field bigger for me. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, that came at a time as well. It's prominent in my life because I had to leave the house at the time. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
like you know, like you said that I was, you know, used to be close to Raekwon and I was, you know, messing with the group Icewater. I'm on Icewater's album. But there was a time where, you know, when you grow up, you leave the house. You don't stay in the house. So, you know, I went on my own journey and started my own label based on what I seen going on. You know what I'm saying? How they was doing their business. I kind of just tried to mimic it, mimic what they was doing. You know, and
mm-hmm.
that turned over. You know, Meth is also from my project. He seen what I was doing, and he was just helping. He was just offering assistance anytime he could. You know what I'm saying?
What did that mean to have a lesson like Meth? Go ahead, Kenny.
No, my apologies, man. I got a little distracted for a minute because I seen something that was seen that they said they had a lion walking down on downtown on my block.
Okay. Nobody wants.
I got a little distracted there. I'm like, I don't know how true that is, but that was stunning enough to make me like, okay, let me get my mind together for a minute. Back to the interview.
Man, look, nobody want no smoke with Simba walking down the street. I'm like, leave Simba alone. Let Simba have his way. He king of the jungle. Guess what? He run the block too. Hans, what did that mean to have a legend like Method offer and be so courteous, so much of being a selfless and giving individual to help you out? You know, because by this time, Meth is already like a legend status in the game.
Right. And, I mean, Meth, it wasn't just me, though. Like, Meth offers assistance and help to, you know, anything he see, you know, his guys doing that's positive. He try to play his part and help as much as he can. So it wasn't just me. You know what I'm saying? But he offered that help to, you know, a lot of people, me included. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that comes with the time with Meth being a team player, because him being and developing as a superstar that he was, he easily could have been the face of Wu-Tang and branched out, but it just shows his strength as a team member. Like, he know he just want to build his teammates up to be better.
Right. Right.
Yeah,
Is T-Max, you there?
And what did he? Yeah, I'm here. And what did he tell you about how the game worked in terms of how you had to navigate it?
I mean, you know, some things I learned on my own. It was just more of a guidance. You know, if something wasn't right and exact, you know what I'm saying, he would, yo, you know, this the way you should do it or whatever, give his 2 cents, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, I take from it and, you know, take from it what I could. And the whole thing is executing it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I just tried to execute a lot of things that made sense and, you know, try to grow my brand.
Absolutely. Tell us about the first time. Tell us about the first time about your first rhyme, in terms of, you know, what you penned and how it launched, and when you really started doing it, in terms of getting your cadence, your delivery, your bar structure, everything that epitomizes the essence of a dope MC. Tell us about those early sessions and the lessons you learned in the process about yourself, about how the art form is articulated.
I mean, I think my cadence and everything developed, wordplay, vocabulary, developed just, you know, being around and in the studio and being able to soak up the things that was around me at the time, you know what I'm saying, and take it and put it together and use it in a way, you know, that's me, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're going into the booth, do you prefer writing or just freestyling your verse?
I'm a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a writer. I prefer to, you know, to write. I think freestyling is, you know, the whole, you know, like battle rap, freestyle, stuff like that, off the top of the head type thing. I think that's a whole different other industry that can branch off from hip hop, because that's a talent all in itself. You know,
yes,
to put words together instantaneously on the spot is a gift. All in it, you know, outside of, you know, being able to construct songs and stuff like that when you have time to do so.
Yeah, and that's always been a question about the aspect of rhyming and its merit. You know, we're all hip-hop to the core, but even we understand everybody's talents are manifested. Everybody's ability is blessed in a certain way. Some people are not natural freestylers, but if you give them 2 or 3 hours or even 15 minutes to write something, it's going to be flame.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then some people are very, very, very deft in terms of spontaneous, you know, construction, you know, of putting together a run. And this is not the shot. This is not to throw shots at anybody. This is just an observation. But sometimes what we've seen with known freestylers who are great, who have made their reputation off of it, sometimes that didn't always translate into great songs. While there was the spontaneity, the incredible imaginary element of, like you said, that instantaneous creation, it didn't always branch into a coherent song that was really structured in a way that was palatable.
Right.
Myself, and I dabbled in rhyme a little bit when I was younger, I always liked to rhyme from a perspective of what I thought about and wrote on paper, because I knew what I wanted to deliver. And to me, to have that meticulous approach enabled me to really be able to, I think, do it justice. When you look at how the art form is today, there's long been ghostwriting in the game. We've known some of the biggest songs in hip-hop history were not written by the artists who performed them. But there's still always that third element, too, in terms of the people who write rhymes for others. I mean, obviously, there was a situation with Quentin Miller and Drake some years ago that Bill brought up about how Drake wasn't writing his own rhymes. There's this stuff said about how Kanye didn't always write his own rhymes, you know, that Rhyme Fest wrote a lot of it. What are your feelings as an artist about that?
I mean, as an artist, I understand the need to make sure that, you know, you want to write your own stuff. However, taking off that hat, taking off an artist's hat and putting on a label on a hat, if I had a artist that was signed and, you know, the roof got took off his career all of a sudden, and, you know, he went from one extreme to another, and now he got mad work, and there's a demand for his music, and he can't keep up with the demand, then me as a label owner, you know, would have to tell him, you got to start pulling from the people around you so that you could meet the quota of the demand that you have now. You know, if, you know, I do that sometimes. I'll be in the studio and I'll be stuck on a bar or something, and, you know, my guy be in the other room writing something, and he'd be like, yo, you should say this. And, you know, sometimes I take it, sometimes I don't. So, you know, that's from two different perspectives, from, you know, the label aspect of it. I think there's nothing wrong with it. But as an artist, I would rather write my own stuff. I wouldn't want to be an artist known for allowing people to write his music.
Hans, I think that is like one of the most brilliantly genius answers that we have ever gotten on this show. And I'm dead serious. I'm saying that with a straight face. Because what you put down, and, I mean, that was deep. That was deep.
Yeah, and you can tell sometimes just by the way these guys' songs, you can tell they just freestyled it off the gate because it ain't structured right. Like, you got a few word sniffs that can actually do that. Like, you got Jay-Z's and the Bigs and all them. They can structure these songs in their head, so they say. But
so they say.
A lot of these dudes, yeah.
But that's, I mean, but the way you broke that down in terms of the nuance, Hans, in terms of talking about, you know, the quantity, in terms of the work, how that artist may not be able to give total attention to the projects that are there at the time, and that there has to be outsourced at certain levels. That's genius. That's a genius answer. I don't think we've ever heard anybody articulate it like that ever. Yeah, that was dope. But like you said, you know, when you're looking at what the label is looking at in terms of how they want their main artist to be constantly churning out hits, because at the end of the day, it is this. You know, the industry is about, it's hit oriented, it's success driven. It is about how do you bring something out there, and once it hits, how can you do more of this? When you look at the state of it from 2009 to now, how have you seen a change in terms of how the music is marketed and how the entry level is for artists to come in?
Again, I feel like it's easier. It's set up in a way where, like you said the word before, outsourcing, right?
Yes, sir.
So it's set up in a way where if a new artist sat down for a minute and you know, looked at what it really takes to put a record out, as opposed to just thinking, okay, I'm going to write mad music, I'm going to go in the studio, burn up a whole bunch of studio time, get mad songs done, and that's going to take me where I need to go.
Right.
And you could be the nicest person in the world. You know what I'm saying? It's set up nowadays in a way where, you know, these kids can, you know, get the knowledge and or listen to someone who's guiding them in the right direction and, you know, do a marketing campaign, set up a rollout. You do it exactly the way these big companies do it because that's the only way it's going to be recognized anyway.
Right.
You feel where I'm coming from? So if you're an independent and you're doing an album, I think a person should get a marketing agency or a PR person at least, and run ads, do all the marketing things that you know that you would expect a Def Jam to do for you. You may not can't do it on that level or that floor, but you can still do it. You know what I mean? And it's nowadays, you don't need to spend a million to make some money nowadays.
Right. How important is it that you have the proper team behind you that understands what your vision is and is consistent in alignment with your goals and your aspirations for what you're trying to do?
It's important. It's very important. It's important to have leaders around you. Because the last thing you need is somebody just, you know, telling you what you want to hear because you want to hear it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's what's called quality control, because a lot of times we see situations where people are happy to be part of the ride to the point that they're going to let you drive with no seatbelt, not knowing the crash is coming, and they'll tell you, like, you need to buckle up the seatbelt or you need to stop the whip altogether, and we need to get out and figure out what's going on because we're seeing, because we're about to hit something. In terms of getting your music out to the people, what has it been like in terms of doing the shows, actually doing interviews, just promoting your product? What's the process been like?
It's been work. It's not easy. You know, it's a marathon. For me, it's a marathon. It's, you know, I'm rolling it out slow. And, you know, I'm just, you know, just trying to do things the way they're supposed to be done so that it'll be respected like a project, you know, put out by any one of these big labels.
Absolutely. And when doing that,
and you know what's also important? I'm going to say, too, that you know what's also important? Like, tell us about the importance, you know, we're in the new social media space, the importance of engaging with your base.
Engaging with my base. Again, I got to say, I kind of had a cheat sheet for that because I have a crutch. I'm going to explain to you what I mean by that. I have a crutch. My crutch is Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang has a 200,000-person fan base, and at any given time, being that I'm connected to that, I'm fortunate enough to have that platform if I put something out. You know, even though I don't have the W on me, that fan base is I recognize to be my fan base, or a portion of that fan base I recognize to be my fan base. So I'm fortunate because I kind of have a platform with you know, a vast amount of people that when I put out, I didn't really have to build it to that. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right. And that's something that is, in terms of that level of branding, in terms of having it, that's something that is always going to help. I tell anybody, there's a difference between riding somebody's coattails and then utilizing the resources that you have. It is not a bad thing when, especially, you know, you are recognized by the Wu as one of them. So this is not like you're just somebody who's mediocre, who's kind of ride the coattails. No, you are a dope MC who comes from a line of dope MCs, and they support you as a dope MC, which is the most important. That's called empowerment. That's called giving you the ability to be a leader in terms of you charting out your own movement and being able to dictate your own destiny.
Right. Absolutely.
So tell us about the first project that you ever dropped and what the thought was behind going into it.
My first project?
Yes, sir.
My first project I did when I was part of Ice Water. That was out of Chef's Kitchen. That was my first project.
Yes, sir.
It wasn't done. I would recognize it now as more of a mixtape because, you know, I wasn't in this mind frame back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And then we did the
the Method Man Presents Hannibal the Great album, where Meth presented the album for me. That was my spoken joint. And I would consider that a mixtape as well because, again, I was still bumping in the walls. I was still doing the wrong things. I was, you know, I was, it was trial and error at the time. But that project is out there. My first commercial project was Barker, was the project before this one. That's out now. Streamed on all platforms. That was my first commercial project. This is, and you know, of course, I executively produced all the three Meth Lab projects. And those are compilation Meth albums that were released. Meth Lab 1, Meth Lab 2, Meth Lab 3. Executively produced those. I'm on those as well. And this should be like my fourth project right here. My personal project.
Looking at what you've overcome, Hans, in terms of what you've been able to accomplish, how gratifying is it to know that even with the odds that were against you, that you overcame and you are excelling excellently at a craft that you not only are dope at, but you have a real passion for, and most importantly, that the people appreciate?
I didn't understand the question.
I said, how gratifying is it for you for everything you've gone through in terms of what you've overcome to what you're doing now, being successful, excelling at your craft, being passionate about it, and having the people respond to it as positively as they have?
It's very gratifying. It's humbling. It's gratifying. I try to compare the two every day to keep me focused on what I'm doing now. You know, a lot of my friends, you know, they tell me, you know, when on the downtime, you know, I might make a reference to jail and, you know, to, you know, stuff like that. They be like, oh, you know, institutionalized or something like that. But it's not that I'm institutionalized. It's just that I always want to keep where I came from in front of me to make sure
I
stay moving forward.
Yes, sir. In terms of press, Hans, how important is it for artists to understand the importance of press in two aspects? Number one, how to conduct themselves during an interview, and number two, how to give opportunities to outlets who may not be as big but are just as important and as substantial.
For the last question, I feel like, you know, even if it's a platform that's going to come up and is up and coming, you know, we're kind of moving in the same direction. We all trying to go up, and you know the saying, high tides raises all ships. So, you know, if you know, we can collaborate and I could do an interview on your platform and that rises both of us because obviously I have another platform I'm talking to, and on your end, you know, you have me on the show. We rise together. So I don't really never look at how big the platform is, as long as, you know, ain't no, you know, crazy stuff on your platform or you're not known for certain crazy stuff. I usually always do the interview.
Yeah,
that's the importance of keeping your reach important, man, because you got to keep your core 300 at bay, man, because they're the one that's going to be your ride or die. You feel me?
Right. Right.
And also, and I think also most important, too, is about artists coming in, understanding, you know, in terms of press, how to conduct yourself. You know, we see in this day and time, you know, you lived in the street life, so you understand how real it is. You don't have to do anything to give credence to it. You have nothing to prove. But yet it's still, you see a lot of youngins out there doing a lot of foolishness trying to prove a point about it on social media. And then when they do interviews, they're acting all silly as well, you know, either being high, drunk, just
acting ignorant on air. Branding as an artist, how important is that to make sure that your image is something presented to the public that is being a confident professional who is not relying on silly tactics and a bunch of stupid shit in order to grab an audience?
You went out. You went out. Hey, Steve, I think you were breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, I'm back. I'm back. Yeah. In terms of when you see artists who get out there and do a lot of silly shit and a whole bunch of nonsense online, how important is it to understand that as an artist, you are a brand, you are a public figure, and how important it is to present your best foot forward as being a consummate professional and letting your talent and not, you know, trouble speak for that talent?
I think it's important for someone to conduct themselves in professionally at all times, even as an artist. At the same time, taking off the hat and putting on an artist hat, me as an artist, an artist might have a rough image that he's trying to maintain. I don't agree with it, but I get it. You know what I mean? And, either you're going to listen to somebody else or it's going to be trial and error for you. You know what I mean? The reality of it is that regardless of what they do, I think it's important for an artist to speak well. I think it's important for an artist, regardless of, you know, if he's smoking a blunt, he should still speak well. If he's having a drink on an interview, he should still be articulate. He should still, you know, be professional in how he addresses people and stuff like that.
Right.
So even if you are rough around the edges and that's your image, there's still a professionalism that can go with that to make what you're doing and the image you're portraying a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you said, you know, there are sometimes we see artists out there who they legitimately do have a lot to, you know, unpack in terms of what it means to be a public figure. But, you know, you have some artists, you know, like, of course, we can only say this because he actually did it. You know, we're not just throwing stuff out. It's like when Kodak Black got out there some years ago when he first started talking about he was better than Tupac and Biggie. And I don't think we believed that he believed that. I don't even think he believed that. But I think he felt like that was his way of being able to get attention where people would pay attention to him. And it's show business at the end, you know.
Market employee for his shit. You know, at the same time, you know,
right.
Should he always think he's better than everybody, being an artist? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, is he supposed to say Pac is better than him? Looking at it at that point, you know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, if he's an artist, he should think he's the best thing on the planet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Kodak Black, the president pardoned him, right?
Yes,
I mean,
sir.
Trump,
yes, sir.
Then
Black. Yeah. Yes, he did.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes we look at stuff like that as such an affront because it's legends that are mentioned that we would say, how dare you, you know, dismiss them in such a fashion of saying that you have, you know, of saying you're better than them and you have not even, you know, reached a certain zenith of their success. So by the same token, you know, like I said, it's show business. And like you said, that level of confidence is imperative in this game. Because this shit is not for the weak. It is not for the weak at all.
You gotta believe in yourself. Like, anybody that come in and say they don't believe they're the nicest rapper out, even if the masses don't believe, you gotta believe in yourself. That had to keep you going, because if you don't believe in yourself, then who is?
Right.
So people from outside looking in, everybody that aren't artists, don't even understand that comment coming from Kodak Black. They're like, they don't even understand,
you know, to whereas if he has another rapper listening to him say that, the rapper might understand, okay, all right, he's an artist. He's supposed to say that. You know what I mean? But for an artist that don't write music, they're not rappers, you know, they're looking at it like, you know, they don't even understand. But like I said, it's just the ability, and that's the hard part with what I'm doing, because it's the ability to take one hat off and put the other one on and be able to understand from that perspective at the same time.
Now, that's a perfect segue, Hans, because we wanted to ask you this question next. Competition is one thing, because hip-hop is its core in terms of the music and around this competition. Sometimes it gets a little personal. But now we're seeing a situation where it's getting really personal with a lot of these artists out there where they're, like, talking about what they're going to do to somebody on site. They're going to blast up somebody, like, fuck the ops. Yeah, nigga, fuck you. Fuck your dead homies. What do artists have to understand for this? Yeah, like, there's no, like, type of, you know, bail.
No barrier being built.
Yeah. You're from the street, Ham, and you've seen shit on the block when shit went bad. How important is it for artists to understand that there's a certain point of entertainment, and then there's a certain point of rhyming, and then there are points of disrespect with lines drawn in the sand that you should never cross when addressing certain people? How important is that?
I think, you know, there was competition. There was things said, you know, coming up back in the days too. But I think the artists back in the days knew that it was just rap. It was just hip hop. That was it. Like, you know, hip hop is engrossed in nothing but competition. When, you know, me coming up in hip hop, everything was a competition. Who was better than who? But it never turned. Right. I've very rarely seen a fight over a rap battle or, you know, somebody being shot over a hip-hop song or, you know, and, you know, people used to say some, you know, might talk about your mother or something like that. But it was just recognized as a sport. Now it's like people taking shit personal, you know, motherfuckers just throwing real threats back and forth, you know what I mean? And you know what? I blame the big companies that's fueling it. You know what I'm saying? Because a lot of, if you take a look at a lot of that stuff that's going on, take a look and see who's behind that. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I've heard more than one occasion the whole beef between Pac and Biggie, like, a lot of people think Vibe is the one that instigated that to sell a magazine.
And we remember that cover, too.
Right.
I believe that was in 1995, you know, the East Coast, the infamous East Coast, West Coast beef issue. You
right.
know, and that was something where this is,
now,
I think, where – oh, go ahead.
No, I was saying, who's to say if they didn't put that magazine out or didn't throw – that cup of fuel on the fire, that the fire wouldn't have burnt out?
You know, it was problematic, Hans, when that cover came out, because it forced everybody to take sides. People who were not even directly involved in it, just by proxy of Coast alone, had to change and deal with their, you know, well, not change up, but they had to team up and ride for their hometown. And the way, you know, shout out to Infamous Mob, when we had them on the show a couple of years ago, and they talked about when they were in California, Los Angeles, they had to check in a hotel under aliases because it was still that hot. You know, it was still that hot out of the West Coast for New York artists.
And, and on top of that, you know, big shout out to Tretch. You know, I talked to Tretch about this, so he said that played a vague role because he looked at it like niggas in the hood on weed artists. They just see east and west, east versus west.
Right. You know, when them lines are drawn, it's like, you know, it's like a curve. You know, even a nigga you don't get along with in your hood, but you both have a perceived common enemy. It's like, fuck that nigga, we'll handle our shit later, but we dealing with this nigga over here. Because he ain't finna diss our shit.
Right.
And that was something that was very, very, very real. How do you feel about how hip-hop is covered now? You know, now back in the days, the magazines were the place to go. Now it's really the internet, the blog. You know, that's where everybody's name and fame is being made. How do you feel about that?
I just roll with the punches. I feel like, you know, the blogs ain't nothing but the same thing as a magazine because it serves the same purpose. And, you know, you got the podcast now that's jumping off for marketing. I think hip-hop is growing, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, the blogs nowadays, especially, you know, our blogs, it's like a news channel. Like, you know, it's white people got it all the time. They got a million talk show hosts that, you know, when people make their rounds, actors make their rounds, they make their rounds through those talk shows and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? So I think, you know, for hip hop, the blogs are young, but the blogs it grew. Hip hop just grew another branch with the hip hop blogs, like, you know, Math Hopper, Drink Champs, $1 million worth of game. You know, you got people starting up new podcasts. You know, I think that's a major accomplishment on behalf of hip hop. Another one, you know, outside of the 50 years.
Absolutely.
Big fact. You know what? And I was going to say this too, man, because you know we was talking about the how these companies be trying to parlay issues amongst artists because it doubles the sales in a way. Because, you know, drama sales, people love, they love car crashes, so to speak. Now,
we already know
the situation that happened with you and Slaughterhouse and all that. So we're not going to get deeper than that. But I want to know for maturity purposes, how did the Slaughterhouse and Wu-Tang end up piece up those misunderstandings and go further?
I didn't understand the last part. What you said?
Yeah, how did Meth and Joe Budden come to the table and just, you know, piece up misunderstandings? Because, you know, we live in a time where people feel like they're too big or too proud to reach out to that person and just squash it. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. That was above my pay grade. I really don't know. You know what I'm saying? That was patched up. It was really nothing personal. You know what I'm saying? With it, it was a situation that happened. I don't want to wrap my career around it. But, you know, I was coming out to play for my team at the time. That's the best way I can put it. Like, you know, a baseball team got a game, like, you know, their players take the field. I was just playing the field then. And, you know, what transpired.
Yeah, understood, definitely understood, because we wanted to let people know about, you know, y'all putting that together and coming together. And let it be known that y'all can put egos aside and just go from there, because there was still some mutual respect there between sets, because just off skill level alone.
Right. Right.
Yeah. But like you said, even when situations happen, so you rode for your team at the time. It's like you said, that baseball analogy. You know, if your guy's up on the mound and somebody throw a foul pitch and hits him, it's a problem. And, yeah,
right.
We're going to say something about it. You know, we might even have a bench-clearing brawl if that's what it comes to, but you ain't finna hit one of my guys.
Right.
So that ain't going to go down.
That's right.
Who do you see in the game right now, Hans, that you really admire for their movement in terms of how they've been able to really grow their brand
and really, really, really get their music out there to the people in a real organic and authentic way.
Like major guys. I mean, I would say, you know, I gotta say my guys. It's kind of like I don't want to sound, you know, like obviously I'm gonna say, but if you look at as far as Method Man is concerned, you see how, you know, he flourished. He's acting. He has the Tocal brand. He has Tocal Athletics. Like, this dude just went from one extreme to another. Like, that's inspiring. You know what I'm saying? You know, somebody that I sit in the studio with and create with is doing all this other stuff. And my whole play the whole time been just copying and mimicking what I should go right for the people around me. You know what I mean? But I like Jada. Jada's, you know, anytime I got a writer's block or I can't, you know, come up with nothing crazy, like, you know, I throw Jada on. It could be old Jada. It could be new Jada. You know what I'm saying? I think Jada's the shit.
Hey, top five dead or alive, said it himself. And Jada is like
Mr. Versus.
Man, dude, when you saw the verses with the Locks and Dipset, and shout out to Swiss Beats and Timbaland for creating the verses, how, in your eyes, Hans, how big was that for the culture to see some of the greatest icons in hip-hop history go head-to-head against each other? To not only showcase their hits, but to give a history lesson to the generation that didn't grow up in, you know, when their music first came out.
I think it was big. I think it was a good thing because it brought to the forefront the level of competition. And, you know, after that, you know, those guys walked away and it was all love. There was no violence that came from the actual competition. Battle rap nowadays, you know, them guys, you know, shout out to them guys. It's like, you know, they enter into that competition peacefully. They say what they got to say, and they walk away peacefully. You know, it's kind of, you know, the opposite of all the violence going on in hip-hop. Right now with a lot of artists getting killed and, you know, whether it be, you know, robberies or, you know, or anything else, you know what I'm saying? Or, you know, if there was any personal beef between them or because of what somebody said or, you understand? It was like leading by example for hip-hop because them guys was able to, you know, Meth and Red did one. You know, Raekwon and Ghost did verses. You know what I mean? Snoop and DMX did a verses.
DC and Gucci.
Right. And that was big because, you know, look at their history.
Man, look. Shout out to Snowman, a good friend of ours. I mean, when I first heard about it, I was like,
they're going to do some rumbling, some furniture going to get moved.
You know what I mean? But, you know, I think it was a good thing. The verses was a good thing for hip-hop. I don't know why they stopped doing it. But I think it was good for hip-hop.
I'm thinking they stopped doing it because, number one, you know, shows that, you know, the country's open back up and people are doing shows again. And number two, I think a lot of the big dogs don't really want to do it because they were talked to Jay-Z to do it, or Nas or Lil Wayne. They probably want a lot of money.
Right.
Or Mary J. Blige. They got to pay up. They got to bring the bread truck for them.
Right. But if you're making money, then why not? You know, I mean, you know, and again, that's these other because I forgot, somebody bought verses from Swiss initially did it, right?
Yeah, it was him and Timbaland.
And then it's a company, it's a network that came and brought that from them.
I think it was called Fightful.
It was called what?
Oh, I think. Hold on, I'm gonna look that up real quick. I think it was some type of, man, what's the name of that company? I'm gonna look that up right quick.
Yeah, so, you know, once these companies inject themselves into this, it goes corporate at that point. So it being good for hip hop is no longer a priority. You know what I'm saying? It becomes what's good for their network at the time.
It was called Thriller.
Who?
It was called Thriller.
Thriller, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it was called Thriller because I remember they actually tried to charge for the Cypress Hill and Onyxburg, and people hated it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So,
they were like,
yeah.
Man, nobody paying for no $4.99. What the hell are you talking about? We got the best ones for free.
Right.
Hold on, make sure. Hey, T-Mac, you there? Yeah, I'm going to have him call back in a little bit, man. But...
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay.
I'm here. Yeah, but that's something where I think the monetization of it, I think for the element of what that was, and I get it, we all do in a business aspect, but at the end of the day, it's for the people. And stuff like that, you don't just, to me, you don't, it cheapens it. You know, there's nothing wrong with making money. We all love money. But even then, we also know the perspective of it, too, that it's about making sure that it's something that is accessible to everybody. So something that is historic, is eventful as it is, certain things you can't put a price on. That's something everybody should be able to see without being charged for it.
Right. And if the people are getting charged for it, then that money should resonate in the artists themselves' pocket, which I understand. That's why I understand all these other artists wanting to get paid. Because think about it. If Mary come out and do a versus against, you know, I don't know, don't hold this against me. I'm just going to throw one out there. Mariah Carey. And they do that in the bar plays. That's going to sell the bar plays out. You understand what I'm saying? Barclays is sold
right out
that night. So why wouldn't Mary and Mariah Carey want to know what the purse is to make sure they get compensated for it?
I think a part of that could be when you bring the competition factor to the mix, like, somebody got to take an L or somebody got to take a W, or a W. I think that's where the egos come to play. You know what I mean? Because at first it started off like a celebration of catalogs, like going on with Snoop and DMX and RZA and Premier. It was just guys playing the songs and telling stories. Somewhere then it got competitive with the Jeezy and Gucci, and that's where they started going with competition from there.
Right. Yeah. But I think it was a good thing because, you know, nothing happened. There was no violence. Look at the 50 years anniversary, right? Ain't no big tours survived this year that booked the new era of artists. Why? Because there's too much violence associated with it, right? Wu and Nas just did United States and overseas. What, 45 days, damn near 2 months, and there was no violence. 50, no violence.
Wu-Tang, no. Yeah, Wu-Tang, no violence.
The only people that survived were the older guys.
Yeah. And like you said, Hans, that's true. We don't want to be throwing stones at nobody.
But by the same token, it's like when you're, it's two things, it's a double pronged. And the other side of what you said about the violence concerns is one thing, but it's also when you look at some of these artists and their songs, some of those songs, even over a 2 or 3 year span, don't age well. And like King
right.
said earlier, you know, hip hop is ever changing. So you're seeing it morph in different ways of how certain songs, you know, are constantly, you know, it's like you're going to have artists who were big 5 years ago, and they're not going to be big today because they didn't keep that momentum up with their music, or the songs just didn't age well in terms of the popularity. You know, they were good for the time, but long term, it didn't really go as long as they thought it would. You feel me?
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. That the songs don't age well. That's deep.
Yeah. You know, and that's, but when you're dealing with that era of hip hop, and that's why it's so special for us, there's considered 3 or 4 iterations of the golden years in hip hop history. When you're looking at 1988, considered the first golden era, the second golden era being 92 through 95, and even 95 to 99. You know, those are considered like the golden eras of it because you saw some of the greatest albums come out in those years. I mean, these are albums that have been out, came out over 35 years ago, and they still hold up today. Illmatic still holds up against anything today. 36 Chambers still holds up against anything. Tupac, you know, Tupacalypse Now still holds up against anything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, OC Time's Up. You know, I'm a, you know, Word Life. That holds up. I mean, it's amazing.
Life After Death. Life After Death.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
When you're in the studio hands, how important is it for you when you're putting out, when you're doing something, to feel like this is something that is for the people and potentially this is going to be classic in terms of how it will live far beyond after you're done doing it?
So when I'm in the studio and I'm making music, you gotta try to start the wave. That's how I look at it. So what I feel is hot, if it's sounding good to me, then, you know, a lot of my people say I'm stubborn like that, because if it sound good to me, then, you know, I want to go with it. I like the way that sounds. I like the way it sounds, right? So when I approach it like that, it's kind of like if any wave starts from this, it's going to be the wave that I started, right? Because what I wrote down what I thought was hot. You know what I'm saying? What, you know, what society is putting out there is hot. That's why you got so many rappers now sounding so much alike, and, you know, everybody's making what society is buying into at. But that timeless, the songs that, well, like you had said before, I think are the songs where that individual artist
absolutely. Does it take long for you to write, or pretty much once you already get it going, you already know what you want to say and you just go ahead and spit it?
Sometimes I hear beats that take me right away, but it depends on who I'm on the song with, who I'm writing with. That plays a role. Sometimes the beat, as soon as I hear the beat, like, it'll start coming to me. You know what I'm saying? And then sometimes I like a beat and have a beat and have to, you know, it might take me 2 days to put something together for it. You know what I'm saying? You know, and then,
what have you learned about the industry politics in terms of how record label deals are orchestrated and how artists handle their business?
I I kind of did my stuff different. Like, I don't have the conventional record deals. I do leases to distributors. So, you know, part of my success, you know, I'm co-owner in Meth Lab Studios. We have a 2,200 square foot facility. All the Meth Lab projects, all the projects came out of that studio. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
So, when
Hold on. Somebody, I have to hold on for one second.
Take your time.
Yeah, we're in the briefing the loo right now on Cuff Radio. King Eric and myself, T-Maxi, alive and direct with Hands On. Definitely have a great deal with him right now in terms of him just talking about his illustrious history in the game. You know, we hope you all are definitely enjoying the bill. And chime in. You know, if you want to chime in.
So once I got the studio, it was like volume. So I was able to create the content, at a high capacity. I just kind of went to the distributors like, you know, my deals are, you know, I'll lease this to you for 10 years. You know what I'm saying? Give me a certain percentage, you know, every quarter, and then after 10 years, the rights to the project comes back to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a conventional deal where a record label gives you money and now they own your stuff and, you know, stuff like that.
Got you. What should artists understand getting into the game in terms of how business is orchestrated, in terms of reading their contract and knowing how to make the most out of it and not just jumping for any opportunity they feel is beneficial for them, but getting deeper to find out is it going to be long-term advantageous as opposed to being immediately beneficial?
I would say get a lawyer. They're all smarter than us. You know what I mean? So I would tell anybody, you know, before you sign anything, and I know it's kind of like people always say this, but yeah, I would go through a lawyer.
Mhm. Yeah, that lawyer. Legal representation. Yeah.
And the other side will respect you for that means of negotiation. If you're doing business in the record industry, they understand the business that they're used to. They're used to doing business with other lawyers. So,
right.
So, you know, outside of us having a conversation, any legal matters with contracts, if you start talking to them, they automatically know you don't know the business. And they'll treat
right.
You as, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, I would just say, I mean, and I get it because it costs money. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, weed prices nowadays, people pay $40 an eighth, smoke three photos.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You could afford to pay a lawyer for $400 to read a contract.
Yeah, having that team and the right legal team in the streets, man, and they'll negotiate you real well.
Right.
Yeah, but that's important though, man, because you know people, you know, we see the horror stories about what happens in terms of when these guys don't have the proper representation, when they don't understand the business of it in terms of how to make sure they're publishing, you know, their percentage points, everything. And then, you know, these guys, you know, end up getting locked into these multiple album deals and don't really have anything, you know, I mean, how to get out of it, even how to renegotiate anything. And that's something that I think needs to really be, it can't be overstated. You know, you need to have your business in order.
I mean, everything from making sure your money's right to making sure that, you know, even your health insurance is good in terms of what a label covered at. Matter of fact, shout out to Nas for him starting a startup company, a startup foundation in terms of making sure that artists have access to health care.
Yes. Shout out to Nas. Salute to that brother, because that's something that is crazy. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's like whoever would have thought that would have been possible in hip-hop. Oh, now rappers could get health insurance? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Or at least like an AARP type of thing where when you're a certain age, you know what I'm saying? You get health insurance. But I think Fat Joe was caught in a stir for something like that too, right?
I think so.
Fat Joe just did something with health care too.
Mm-hmm. But that's something.
It's good to see that these guys are using their power and their influence for the betterment as well, because healthcare is a must, man, like, especially with the way Medicaid is running.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
And health is wealth in industry hands. How important is it to pretty much, as you get into the industry in terms of understanding how to take care of yourself, you know, how to, especially, like, when you do shows, how important is, do you have a particular health regimen that you enact in terms of making sure that you're in peak physical condition for when you perform?
Not this far, but that's something that I have to definitely start paying attention to. Like,
yes, sir.
I always felt like I've been healthy all my life. But, you know, now that we're getting older, it's like you got to start shedding light and watching your health a little bit more. So, you know, I just don't take nothing for granted like I did before. So that's just something I'm working on. You know what I mean? I'm working on that now. But I just, you know, it was like a given. I figured that I was healthy, I was good, you know what I mean? But, you know, we all get older, so, yeah, that's something that I got to start working on.
Tell us about the first show that you ever did, and what was that like?
The first what?
The first show that you ever did, your first live performance, and what was that like?
Shit, I got booed. Well, I got booed. That's what that was like. Shit was horrible. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But,
hey, it happens. It happens. But look at where you're at now. You know, you're still doing it, and you didn't let that deter you.
Right. Nah, but I'm talking about young. I was mad young. Like, I've been, you know, doing music for a long time.
Yes,
unprofessional,
sir.
You know what I mean? So when you asked me the first show, you know, I kind of went back kind of far. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
My first show as an adult, it was scary. You know what I'm saying? It was scary. You know, that's a whole nother process in it, because you got to make sure your stage shows are set up the correct way, especially if you're doing multiple shows. If it's just not a one-off, you know, you find what works, you change things, and try to make the next show better. But
right.
My first show as an adult was scary.
That level of vulnerability that you just talked about in terms of what it means to be out there in a performer, like Erykah Badu said on, you know, her classic Tyrone the Beginning, she said, I'm an artist and I'm sensitive about my shit. What do people need to understand about not only just rappers, but just singers, poets, hell, even athletes in general, about how they're sensitive about their art?
I mean, I gotta say, I mean, I think it's cool. I think you should be sensitive about your art because, you know, if a person that always trying to keep, his blade sharp, so to speak, meaning, you know, you keep his writing up, making sure things sound the way they're supposed to sound sonically, you know what I mean? So, you know, if somebody don't like it, then I can see people getting emotional and shit like that, you know what I mean? It's not, the thing is what you do with it after that.
I'm thinking mm-hmm. one of the problems is now with, it's one thing to be a critic, but I think it's also a problem where you have people building transactions and clout off that critique, you know, as we call hot takes.
Right.
We're in a hot take era right now. Like, you can just say one thing, like, this person's album is trash. And, you know, that person could probably take it like, that's affecting my bottom line. That's affecting, it's one thing to be respectful about the art or anything, like, you know, if the beats ain't hitting or certain layers is not hitting, but to dismiss it as overall trash, now that's gonna affect the public perception of what you're bringing, and now that's gonna affect your bottom line. People wore his whole weight.
I think in this new day, I've had people tell me that before, or comment on a song that was out, you know, somebody, you know, outright, yo, that shit trash. You know, even though I speed by it, it still hit me a little bit. So, you know, I get it. You know what I mean?
Right.
I get it. It still hit me. Do I let it affect me? No, but does it affect me? Yeah, internally or whatever, because in my mind it's like, damn, this nigga think my shit is whack. You know what I mean? But, you know, when the internet has the ability to give you a bigger reach. So, you know, when you look at it from a perspective of the whole world that at the time, if you get one, you're definitely going to get one or two bad comments. You know, it's all good.
And that's a way to take it, man, because when you're thinking about it, you know, like King said, you know, we're always going to have our views on what we like and what we don't like, and that's okay because we're all human and music is subjective, art is subjective. You know, not all of us are going to respond to something the same way, but I will stand on business saying this. There's a difference between having an honest criticism and then basically trying to poison somebody in terms of being unnecessarily vile and straight up disrespectful. Because to me, that's when it goes into a personal issue of you're trying to totally destroy somebody's confidence, which is never cool. And and that's where shit starts going out there, out the window. It's like a diss record. You may not like a nigga, but when you start saying certain things that are disrespectful, and the motherfucker, you know, slide up and he dropped 30 on you, and we don't mean like KD, you know, in a game, you know, there's certain things you put out there, and you're going to get that energy back. And people say, oh, well, such and such, word. I'm like, no, words have meaning if they have, if people have feelings. You put that shit together, it's going to have consequences if the wrong words come out. And a lot of people need to understand that. Like King said, this hot take society we live in by a bunch of pseudo-journalists has become reckless and dangerous because everybody says, well, I just have an opinion. I'm like, well, yeah, you have a right to have an opinion. Just like we have a right to fucking free speech. But what does the free speech in this country say? It does not mean the right to be hateful or to incite violence. People's free speech does not entail you disrespecting somebody and basically trying to destroy their confidence.
Right.
Well, you know, we look at certain people, you know, like a certain artist who spoke about somebody's album called it trash. I'll say his name because it's already been documented. You know, we look at what Joe Budden said about Eminem's album, and with Joe, it's like, okay, I get it. You created a lane for yourself in terms of being an internet personality, and I'm like, that's fine. From a perspective of respect for him, even if you don't like it, that's not a guy you make a hot take off of, especially a guy who, in a sense, is paying you. Even then, there's a respect there. If you're not feeling his project, you take that and you talk to him behind closed doors about it. You don't air that out publicly because, number one, it makes you look like you're ungrateful, and number two, for Joe, that reinforces the stereotype of him being condescending and dismissive. And when you deal with people and you have that reputation, you're going to get what you get in terms of how people respond to what you say. And I just use him as an example because that's one of the most prevalent. You know, that was just like, me and King, when it happened, we were like, Joe, you ain't have to say that. You ain't have to carry it with him like that. Y'all are bored. That's not a band. You know, friends don't do each other like that publicly, even in the name of journalism, because then that becomes yellow journalism.
Right.
But that's something that I think is about how people really begin to understand how this stuff works. Who do you rock with right now in the industry that you really, the music that you really love in terms of what they're putting out and the type of music that they're doing?
I mean, I like everybody. You know what I mean? I like everybody. I like, as far as New York is concerned, you know, you got Scarlett that, you know, they got some stuff out. You got Nims that got some stuff out. You know what I'm saying? Like, I kind of try to feed off of everybody. You know what I mean? Well.
Yes, sir.
Who would you like to work
with? And, you know, going.
Go ahead, King.
Yeah, I was going to say, and you know, and going on to your solo project right now, the one that you got coming out, I mean, that is already out right now. Do you have any visuals that you're working on?
Yeah, the visual. We dropped a commercial that's up right now. We dropped a video with Book Rock from Helter Skelter, Drawn Brows, and Last American B-Boy. We got a video up right now. I got a Meth video coming. I got one video coming before the album drops on December 1st. We've been rolling it out since October 13th. Like, I got three singles out right now from the project with a commercial and a video. So we got two more videos coming, you know, and then on top of that, on the label side, you know, I got other projects dropping after this, you know, King Just. I don't know if you remember King Just from
Warriors Staff. Drum. Hey, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Memphis Taylor got a project dropping on my imprint. Right after this rollout, you know, I got Carlton Fish that's dropping a project on this imprint. Cortez, the battle rapper. I don't know, you know, if you're in the battle rap, but Cortez is nice, and you know he knows how to put songs together. He got a project coming out over there. You know what I'm saying? So we got a lot of things going on. You know, we got a Meth Lab 4 with Inspector Deck on the horizon. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's a lot being done. Album release party, you know what I'm saying? December 2nd, SOBs. You know what I mean? Anybody want to come out, Method Man, flyers up, look at my social medias. You know what I mean?
The legendary SOBs. Man. Oh, my goodness.
you know. So
how exciting is it for you to have all these projects coming with all of these people, man, and to know you're still keeping the culture alive in such a big way?
I mean, you know, it's not done yet. It's still a vision, but you know, I'm enthusiastic. I'm definitely enthusiastic. I eventually probably want to go over, you know, in the film, maybe making a documentary or something, you know what I mean? Pitch it to these networks. You know, there's a million networks nowadays.
Right.
Everybody looking for content. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I just want to stay focused on being someone who can create content, you know what I'm saying, at a high quality. So, you know, who knows? You know what I mean?
You said documentary, Tam. What are some of your What are some of your favorite movies or documentaries that you've seen?
Shit, I like all documentaries, American Gangsters documentaries. I watched all of those. Like, I watched those. I like those because, you know, it's real history. You know what I mean?
Hey, well, shot. You got the real players that was involved with those situations.
Right. Real history. And it wasn't the history that was fed to us when we was sheltered and going to school, and you know, our parents made sure we were doing our homework, and you know what I mean? We ain't get to watch nothing with violence in it. Like, we missed a lot of the stuff that these, you know, these documentaries. The documentaries where they're interviewing the actual person, those documentaries, you know. Because if somebody doesn't, you know, it can still be fiction. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. What's your vision for your ultimate documentary or what you would want to do? What would it be about and how would you do it?
I would try to mix a documentary type of thing in with actual, you know, the actors acting out the actual stories that, you know, are being told. You know what I'm saying? So it would be like American Gangster. What series is it? Any series have Power together. But let's say Power, those characters were the real characters, that they was interviewing the real characters while they was playing out those particular scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Hey, you know, with Wu-Tang Clan get their free celebration and appreciation. What are your thoughts with the miniseries that they had?
Honestly, I didn't even watch it, but I watched a couple of them. Like the ones I watched, I liked it, but it was fictional. You know what I'm saying? It was fictional. So a lot of people missed that. That's one of the things I drew from it. A lot of people missed the fact that it was fictional. A lot of the stuff that they acted out that happened was a fictional story. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was wrapped around truth, it's still a fictional story.
Right. And when you think about that, how important is it for stories to be told by us
to us and not having somebody else who's not from the culture or having an understanding or appreciation of history telling it.
How important do I feel? It should be like that?
You said what now?
You said how important do I feel that it should be like that?
No. How do you feel about it in terms of how our history and our culture within the history should be told by us? Because we have a lot of people who are kind of trying to dictate to us what certain elements are, and they are not. How important is it for us to maintain that level of our having a hold on
it? Right. Right. I think it's very important. If you're telling a story and you're doing something that's not fictional, then you know, you should have those people telling you that story. You know what I'm saying? You shouldn't try to inject anything into the story if the person that did is telling the story. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, I think that's something with a lot of people that's been concerning, because we have, it's just like with the music. We look at a lot of the corporate entities and how they've infiltrated the culture, and people say hip-hop is dead. No, hip-hop is not dead. Hip-hop is thriving. But the problem is that there has to be accountability in terms of what I think consumers are listening to, and there needs to be accountability in terms of the artists that are being broadcast. If you know they're not good, don't listen to them. If you know the artist is not good, don't sign them. But there has to be accountability from all aspects. How do you feel about where radio is in terms of how it's become corporate and how sometimes the real, you know, dope artists don't get that attention or notoriety to get on?
I don't really look at that as, I try not to look at that as a threat, but obviously, you know, it is in this industry. Radio is a big part. But, you know, once, again, it's being impartial. It's like, yo, the business side of it, the radio got to pay bills. That company got to pay bills. Right? So obviously you're going to play the stuff that gets the most, you know, whatever it is, demand, you know, so they could sell their ads. I mean, it's all politics, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, that was, you know, hip hop's grown to a point where it's probably going to take some time to, you know, to strategize with it now, because there's so much stuff going on now with hip-hop. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I think radio is an important component to it. If an artist can get radio play, obviously money is a big asset, you know, aspect of it. Budget is a big aspect of it, because if a person got enough money, he can keep his stuff spinning all day because of the politics of the radio. You know what I'm saying? You don't have your K-Slays no more. You know, God bless the dead.
Rest in peace. Rest in peace, K-Slay.
You know what I'm saying? We had did some work with him with one of the mixtapes that we actually toured on. That's the Back to Sicily mixtape, the Hannibal the Great mixtape. But anyway, it's like, you know, these DJs nowadays are playing. I like what Flex is doing. Shout out to Flex, because you know, he's using that platform to play what he think is hot. It ain't about, you know, the politics of it with Flex. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he do the whole thing with this is what New York sound like, and you know, people say what they want about Flex, but it, you know, you know, the whole unreleased things that he was releasing from different artists sending stuff in, and it was a matter of the email. Like, if the artist sent him an email, he liked it, he playing it. He kind of cut the record label out of it. I mean, not the record label, the record station out of it because of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need radio no more to break a record.
That's big fact.
You don't need a radio station no more to break a record. You can break a record right now on the internet and be good.
Plus, you got to look at it too, man. Like, it used to be a time where you literally had to pay almost $500K just to get a record snip. The good thing about the internet is it destroyed the middleman.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the one thing about it, I think. And I think that's one element of the game. Yeah, and I think that's one element of the game, y'all. It's really been dope because artists, you know, back in the day you had to go through so many hoops to get your music out. You know, you had to, you know, we talked about it so much. You know, you had to get the demo, then you had to get it to the label. The label had to actually listen to it. Then there was still no promise of a record, but then you might get a video shot for it. Then the video gets shot because of the single, and then you got to wait to see if the single takes off. Then, okay, it's good. Now we can maybe start talking about an album. So it was a lot. And nowadays, you know, you just put it out yourself and see how the people react.
Right. Right.
You know, but that's one of the reasons why the culture is thriving. You know, the artists today are taking it in their own hands. You know, but we would just wish that some artists would exercise more responsibility in terms of understanding what they're putting out. We're not saying you can't put out music. No, you can. We just want to make sure you're putting out quality music. That's a representation of who you are. You know, you want to make sure that you're putting out something that years from now you can look back and say that you're proud of.
So yeah, we've been on here like 2 hours, so I'm gonna have to go. But
yeah,
I understand. You know what I'm
saying?
That's
about quick.
Yeah, dude.
Huh?
It 2 hours went by fast.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? So I appreciate y'all. Tag me, whatever y'all do with it. I appreciate it. You know what I'm saying? And definitely, I'm going to stay in tune with y'all because, I might want to come back and bring, you know, the other artists that I have with me. And, you know,
absolutely.
On a
video.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll be back anytime. And thank you so much again.
All right, then.
All right, man.
Peace.
King, take us out. Peace.
All right. On that note, we up out of here. Catch us at another time, at another time, at another channel, man. Big thank you for answering, for chopping it up with us. You can catch the replay on the Blog Talk Radio link that you listen to right here, and you can check us out on YouTube at Off the Cuff Radio for content, music, commentary, all that, man. So we out.
Peace.